Welcome to the Bloody Broads Pod. We are your Bloody Broads. I'm Bhavna Sharma.
And I'm Jamie Howard. We are your horror guides from page to screen and everything in between. Bhavna, it's your birthday month.
Yes, so it's my birthday week, actually, when this comes out.
Is it? Okay, good. I was gonna try to cross-reference our calendar.
Yes.
So given that it is your birthday week, what made you choose this movie to celebrate, and what movie are we covering this week?
Well, we're covering Interview with the Vampire, the movie, not the TV show. I haven't watched the TV show yet, otherwise there would be some cross analysis in here. But the 1994 classic Interview with the Vampire, and why is because this movie had such a chokehold on me in the 90s. Like, much like other millennials, this is probably most of the reason why I'm into vampires. And why vampires are my favorite horror mythological creature, and they always will be in any iteration. I am not a purist, so, you know, just saying that off the bat, I am not a purist. So, because I mean, even if you've read any of Anne Rice's books, she's not really a purist either in some cases. And if you've watched this movie, you can tell that too. But yeah, no, I like it. I thought we should dive into some 90s horror that has had its heyday, has been talked about a lot, and has been resurfacing in recent history with the resurgence of the TV show. So why not is my answer. Why the fuck not?
So this is the third vampire movie that we've covered. I think it's safe to say that we fully enjoy vampires.
Yes.
I love this film. I actually had not seen it fully until college, but I had seen clips of it, you know, playing on different TV channels. And then in high school, I came across a copy of the book from a friend, I guess. It was in the back of like an English teacher's room. Went to a super small conservative private Christian school, so I doubt it was actually the teacher's.
Read it the could book. Be.
It could have been. I don't know. She was a cool teacher. Read the book, didn't see the full movie until college, fell in love with it, as every Tumblr girl circa, you know, 2012 through 2014 did.
Yes.
And we're going to go pretty in-depth on this, you guys. I'm really excited that Bhavna wanted to cover this. Again, it's a quintessential 90s horror film that is not a slasher, technically.
Yes.
And
I mean, it's not a slasher, but many throats were slashed in the making of this movie.
Correct. We had a lot of blood, and not just blood from them sucking their victims, but famously sort of towards the end of the film, we'll discuss Louis burning everything down and how he kills some of the other vampires.
The place does not only get burnt down once, it gets burnt down twice.
He pulls a Waiting to Exhale twice in this film, which I personally love.
Double toasted, my friend. Double toasted.
Double toasted. So some quick highlights. We are going to talk about queer coding, the use of women and women as objects, infantilization of women, and of course, sexuality of all flavors.
So oh my lots God. Of all the flavors.
Every flavor that you can, 31 flavors, imagine.
Yes.
So right off the bat, this movie, this casting was incredible, especially for 1994. Can we talk about it? Because listen, 12-year-old me was living. I was getting to sneak those, you know, clips in on TNT or whatever it was airing on.
Yes. Oh my God. Okay. Everyone was beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Everyone, including Christian Slater, who I love that his character in the book is just called The Boy. And I'm like, no, this is the man.
That's a man. That's a grown
That's
man.
A man. That's a full ass man. But no, like, oh my God. Like, okay, I just wanted to touch upon Christian Slater first because no one ever talks about Christian Slater whenever they're talking about Interview with the Vampire. Or if they are, I haven't seen you. So please hit me up with any media you have on that.
Yes.
But please, please do. We love Heathers in this house. But he has such a limited role, yet he's essentially the secret titular kind of role in this movie as well. Like, he is the one conducting the interview with the vampire. And yet we're like, he's easy to forget. And I don't mean that as an insult. I just mean that in like, the story is so rich that like, I often forget that like, Louis is telling the story to him.
I hear what you're saying. Easy to forget in that he's not a pivotal part of the movie. He's a bigger part of the book.
And he's a big part of my heart.
I was going to say the same thing. That man has aged like the finest of wines. Truly, I've had a crush on him since I saw him in Heather's, downloaded illegally, also from Tumblr. I think he's the perfect face to kind of project the everyman of a creative pursuit. I think he plays writer as well. He plays any sort of creative field really well.
Teenage dirtbag.
Oh, listen, I was hot under the collar for him and Heather's. A 14-year-old me was seriously, who is this?
Yeah. Honestly, Christian Slater walked so that Skeet Ulrich could run.
Correct. Christian Slater, if you can't tell, we're a big fan.
Yes.
So the other, of course, more famous pair in this film are Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise. And I am going to give you one of my hottest of takes right off the bat. This is probably one of Tom Cruise's best performances.
Oh, hell fucking yeah. Hell fucking yeah. I'm sorry. We have a lot of friends that love what do they call it? Two top, two gun.
And all these other things. I hate that movie, which is also a hot take. Cannot believe I saw it. But anyways.
Oh my, I never saw it. Everyone's pushing me to see it. And I'm like, I kind of don't want to. Cause like, I only have room in my heart for one Tom Cruise franchise. And it's not even for Tom Cruise. I love the Mission Impossible movies.
I was going to say, yeah.
And it's literally not even for him. It's for like everybody else in the cast always. I see you, Simon Pegg. I love you. This is his best performance and hot take. This is before he got pulled into a group that he is now very famous for being a part of. Before he was pulled in full time, like publicly.
Yeah.
So I'd like to say this is one of his last free performances.
Truly. And you can tell, I think, going back and watching some of his other stuff, I think you can tell.
Mm-hmm.
He plays a very, you know, sort of, I don't want to say, he's not depressed because that's more of Louis's character, but he's cynical.
He's cynical and he's despondent and he's looking for a renewed joie de vivre that he's putting in Louis. And you see it time and time again. Like, and then he sees Louis pulling away from him. He makes Claudia. When he sees Claudia pulling away from him, he threatens her with the making of somebody else. Like he's very like, he's, you cannot not draw parallels to an abusive, like, romantic relationship. And you can't tell me he did not play him by.
Oh, listen. No, we're absolutely going to get deep into that. Yeah. And then we, of course, have Brad Pitt, who is now, unfortunately, a very problematic figure who turned out to be not a great person.
No, which pisses me off because I love this movie so much.
Right. And in this film, he really is just pretty to look at, which I think is fair.
He is. But it's like, I can't picture anybody else's Louis at the time, at least. Like,
absolutely not.
I think he did capture the pathetic, the perfect pathetic essence of Louis. And not to say that Louis is pathetic, but he comes across as very like Eeyore made vampire.
Yeah. No, I agree with that wholeheartedly.
And like, it didn't require a lot of work, I think, to portray that. But like, Brad Pitt did a pretty decent job doing it at the time. Like, I went through my Rolodex of like 90s heartthrobs that could possibly play him. And I'm like, I can't think of anybody that possibly could that wouldn't make it camp.
Correct. And this would have been a very easy movie to go camp in. And I'm glad we didn't. This movie does what I think all genre movies that are great do well, which is it takes itself seriously. And then, of course, we do have Kirsten Dunst, who will get into just truly one of the best actors, I think, period. But as a child actor, really just brought the house down with this performance.
Oh, my gosh. And this is the second child role of hers that we're talking about, too.
Yes, it is.
We covered Tower of Terror last year. And now we're covering this. This would have been before Tower of Terror, because I think she was a teenager by the time Tower of Terror was made.
Which is wild to me, because she should have won so many awards for this movie.
Right? Every time I see it, I'm always like, why did she not get her flowers then? You know?
Truly. Listen, again, I think that Kirsten Dunst is severely underrated outside of the industry in general. So,
oh, yeah.
We love everyone in this movie. We love vampires. And vampires are just romantic, which I know sounds so cliche, but they just are. And I know there's all these psychoanalysis explanations of why, but I really just think it's the idea of having someone so passionate for you that they hunger for you. I find that so hot.
It does. And it's like, vampires are for the emo girls. Like, gorgeous, gorgeous emo girls love vampires. And I will not take that back, because I am one. But it's just that, like, you say it so well, like, just having someone that's so passionate for you that they hunger for you, that is, like, a super romantic.
That's so hot.
Obviously, we put an asterisk and we go with consent, always consensual, consent, consent, consent.
Right. And I think sort of on the same thought process, you know, vampires just come with a certain sexuality, period. I mean, sucking someone's neck is inherently a sexual thing. So the queer undertones of this film are less subtext and more just text. We get two dads raising a daughter.
He literally says, like, this is our daughter.
Right.
Like, you're an only child to Claudia.
Right. And Lestat literally offers Louis an alternative lifestyle, which, if you are not intimately familiar with sort of the fight for gay equality and gay marriage and LGBTQ rights in America, the famous phrase that used to be tossed around much more than it is now is people calling being gay or being bi or anything except for heterosexual a quote-unquote alternative lifestyle. And so I find it really interesting that this coming out in 1994, you know, the book was written in the later
70s.
Yeah, yeah. So not quite at the height of the AIDS epidemic yet, but still.
Just before.
Right, just before. So there's a lot of, again, it's subtext that come across. It's just text.
And if that wasn't clear enough, the opening shot should have done it for you. They're in San Francisco. Like, in the book, they're not. But in the movie, they're in San Francisco. And if there is one thing that is a stereotype about San Francisco, is that it is a haven for these people, for, like, the queer community. I was about to say these people. I meant vampires in that sense. I apologize. Listen, it's a port town. You got ships coming in. They got to clean out the rats, you know?
Right. You know, I've never put two and two together until you said that. I've never been like, oh yeah, he's in San Francisco. Of course he's in San Francisco. But that is, frankly, like, hilarious. I've never thought of that.
Yeah, it's like, I thought of that a long time ago, only because when it was funny, it's like, this movie came into my life before I got hip to, like, you know, the queer history and all that kind of stuff.
Of course.
And then I was like, wait a minute, this takes place in San Fran.
You're not slick, Anne Rice. Because notably, Anne Rice wrote the novel, but then she also got the chance to adapt it into this screenplay, mm-hmm. which I think is really interesting because, you know, there's not a lot of book writers who get to turn their own book into a film adaptation.
No, and not one that, and one that ends up being very successful.
Correct.
Because that's another thing.
Right. And famously, you know, they did try to turn the second two books in this series into a film, Queen of the Damned, which, again, is a kind of a cult following and was a critical flop. And she pulled a Stephen King with a Shining and said, you know, I don't like this adaptation. They mushed my books together and made a mess of them.
because it wasn't Queen of the Damned, it was Queen of the Damned and the Vampire Lestat. And they took out all the best parts of the Vampire Lestat trying to make Queen of the Damned work. And that didn't really work. And then you didn't really have... Sorry, I could go on this for a whole other episode.
Listen, we'll eventually cover Queen of the Damned because it is... I enjoy it. But yes, it's not the book.
I enjoyed it as its own film. I didn't enjoy it as part of this. I look at it as a standalone. I don't look at it as like a continuation at all.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. Same.
Because it's not.
So... interestingly enough, there is the queer, again, vague subtext. It's very blatant. But there's a race subtext that naturally comes to this Louis is a former plantation master. So he was overseeing enslaved people. And it's brought up a lot because it takes place so much in New Orleans, or as Louis says, New Orleans. I mean, let's talk about it. Race in this film is just weird. You know, the first woman that we see them kill, specifically Lestat kills her, is a woman of color. And, you know, she's serving at this very bawdy theater performance that's based on Commedia dell'arte. And very sexual, very, you know.
Such was the style at the time.
Right. So I just think it's really interesting that a lot of the women in this film, even if they are not overtly a different race than white, they are heavily insinuated to be quote unquote a mix.
Yeah. There's a few women that clearly aren't white, but you can't put your finger on what they are because they're probably mixed race or something along those lines. And a lot of implications to unsavory things. .. Just like we're gonna, you made a very good note about that later, about the servant in the home played by Thandie Wayne Newton.
Yes, we love her.
Yes, but like it's, this is where it gets like not tricky to talk about. Like this is where it gets like, okay, you had that like interesting mix of like, okay, in that weird bubble of the 90s where like everyone thought everything was okay. Like, at least that's kind of like the 90s I grew up in, which is like everybody thought women were already equal. Like we already got the equal. We already had equal rights. Everyone thought racial equality was already a thing. Like, you know, because of X, Y, and Z, A, B, C, all the racism became microaggressions. Everybody put their like gaze upon queer people at that point. Like that's where the gaze turned to because of the AIDS epidemic and all that kind of stuff, amongst many other things that are stupid. And that a lot of us millennials had to unlearn growing up. But like, you know, that bubble didn't burst again until like the early aughts. Because we were living in this like false sense of like, yay. So this movie came out in the middle of it. So we're thinking, and I'm thinking the filmmakers thought like, okay, cool. We're going for historical accuracy in a vampire movie of like the late 1700s. Or like mid 1700s, like, okay, we've got people of color here. Yes, they're going to be working in the brothels, in the casinos, in the whatever, all that kind of stuff, on the streets as sex workers, but also on the plantation as enslaved people because slavery is a thing. And I thought they kind of tried to shush that part a little bit, you know, wherein you only get the plantation folk until the enslaved people, only when it came time to like for them to do voodoo or for them to like revolt.
Yes. So let's go ahead and dive into that because, like I said, race plays a funny, not funny, haha, funny, weird role in this movie. So Louis's mistress is a light skinned woman and her name is Yvette. She is played by Thandie Newton and she is a house enslaved person. And for historical context, there was absolutely that divide between enslaved people who were forced to work in a field or outdoors in general, or do sort of the quote unquote dirty work versus the people who were forced to serve inside. But she acts like he's just incredible. I mean, she's like, are you sure you're not hungry? And we know you haven't come out to the slave quarters recently, so it's implied is they there have any interest.
Is there any of our like master left in you?
Right. Which Wow. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine.
Stockholm syndrome.
Truly. Well, also, I think it's Anne Rice's romanticization of the South at the time. I think
she does that.
She does that a lot in some of her other books. But, mm-hmm. you know, again, it's probably one of the more problematic points in this film. It's one of the only things they don't address is race. They sort of speak to the fact that, you know, Kirsten Dunst's character is forever a child, and that Lestat gave Louis a choice, and mm-hmm. there's all these other conversations to have around consent, but then...
Because it weirdly plays a big role in this, but not for women?
Right, exactly. But finally, the enslaved people on the plantation get fed up with Louis because they know what he is. That's what the phrase is yeah. used in the film. They, you know, they know what you are. And
yeah.
they are shown doing this voodoo ritual.
Yep. And if you guys have listened to our episode last month at this point on Sugar Hill, we talk about how we talk about the voodoo ritual in that and how that's a little less Hollywood than most stuff, kind of like this, where like you don't really have a clear picture, you just kind of have the idea that they're doing a ritual, whereas like in Sugar Hill I feel like you have the clear intent from beginning to end, whereas in this one it's just kind of like, okay, we're stabbing a doll and now we're doing a dance. And I can't speak to the accuracy of the dance or anything, but if I'm looking at it from like a okay, this is just 30 seconds enough for me to know that the plantation people are doing their version of smoke mount.
And they shake a chicken.
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't think these three go together. Again, I'm ignorant to how voodoo rituals work. So like, please, if right. anybody knows, please tell us if that made any sense to you or if that's accurate, because I can't speak on that. But to me, in a cinematic sense, I was like, okay, so it's just literally there as a device to tell me that they're fed up. And it's like, it was essentially akin to, if you've seen Beauty and the Beast, kill the beast. Kill the beast.
That's basically what it amounted to. So, yes, race plays a very, we're going to say awkward space in this film, because this is written by a white woman. Originally, the book coming out in 1976, the movie coming out in 1994, the script was worked on for a very long time before that. So,
that's. Yeah, it took her like 20 years and several books before it got published, before it got greenlit.
Right. So, that's a very interesting conversation we would love to hear people's thoughts on. If you have them, please feel free to add us. We'd love to hear them. And sort of how Louis gets found out is, you know, Lestat, after he's turned Louis, they go back to Louis's plantation, which yep. Is beautiful. But
it's an indigo again, plantation.
Yes. Which indigo has its own special spiritual properties across spiritual practices, which I find really fascinating. But Louis realizes I have to kill people to survive. Funny that he doesn't have a problem with owning people, but his line is killing them to survive.
Funny he talks about how his wife and newborn son die and he wants to join them and yet still has a tryst with one of the people that he's enslaving. Just saying. So much he wanted to die.
Lots of Gone with the Windification happening. But Lestat is telling him, you know, hey, we have to at least pretend, because your enslaved people are getting freaked out that you're not eating. So one of my favorite parts of the film, Lestat cracks open a rat, like a cold one. He picks him up and just it's, you yes. know, uses his little weird thumb nail but ring. Yeah. To yeah. slash the rat and drain yeah. him into the cup. It's very strange.
His little cocaine thumb thing.
Yes, but it's very funny. And then it is.
Because to me, honestly, fun fact, because I didn't see this in theaters because I was too young. I was yes. only 6 years old. But I did see it on VHS. We did rent it from Blockbuster. If you kids don't know what Blockbuster is, please just Google it. I can't. It's not a TV show. But I remember seeing that, and that's kind of how I was introduced to rigor mortis.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, because like I had no, I was like 7 or 8 years old. I had no idea that bodies went all stiff when they died. Like I didn't have to go to a funeral at that point in my life. Right. Like I, whatever. And then I was like, I literally had to ask. Like I was like, I forgot who I asked. It must have been like my friend's parents or a teacher or something. I was like, why did that rat go all stiff? Like.
So Louis is drinking the blood of these rats on his plantation as, again, as if they're Budweisers, to stay alive. Meanwhile, Lestat is coercing him to host these high society parties because Lestat literally eats the rich. He says,
oh yeah,
evildoers are easier and they taste better.
Yeah. He has this whole like scene where he talks about like how this one woman literally paid this other guy to kill her husband and then blamed it on their enslaved people and then blah, blah, blah. And like, see, so you should probably kill her. You're doing the world a favor.
I mean, truly just such a messy, messy man.
Love it. I love mess.
Yes. Lestat is such a drama queen. And then of course, from there, we get this very striking image that we were speaking about right before this, where the people who are enslaved are dancing with torches in front of Louis's plantation because Louis's like, fine, I can't live like this. Burn it all down. You know, he accidentally kills Yvette from drinking from her and choosing not to turn her into a vampire. He completely drains her.
Which, thank God, I don't think she would have been able to survive that, to be honest, the psychological portion of it at least.
Right.
He barely did.
Can you imagine her still being alive in 1994 and with him and realizing how screwed up their entire situation was?
She would have killed him like he killed, like he tried to kill Lestat.
Oh, correct. Correct. So we get that amazing striking image. It's honestly one of my favorite shots of the film, and this film is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Like it still holds up in its visuals.
This film visually is just so stunning. The costumes, the lighting. I gotta say, I would wear everything in this film.
Oh my God. Yeah, definitely. Like I have a shirt that I call my Lestat shirt and it's a black shirt, but it's got like lace, like loose arms and a collar and like all that kind of high collar and all that stuff. And I'm like, it's my Lestat shirt. Like,
I love it.
Honestly, it's a vibe. It's a whole vibe.
So once they burn down Louis's plantation, they start renting rooms along the waterfront in New Orleans. And again, Lestat is really just showing his whole ass at this point in the film because he uses sex workers as his plaything. He even tells Louis, this is the part I enjoy the most, is the torturing.
Yeah.
I mean... The fact
he likes
that,
to play with his food.
Right. The fact that there's this big conversation we could have around violence and women's pleasure.
Yeah.
So to me, it's a really heady mix of grooming us to be into violence, to be into being subservient and submissive and honestly, sexually violent. And then sort of reinforcing that through making the violence sexy. And I'm not talking about kinky because that's a whole other conversation, but it's expecting us to be submissive and into it. But then you are told if you do enjoy that, you're degrading yourself and you don't have any self-respect.
Or like I paid you and that's why you're acting like that if he's with a sex worker.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, that's a whole other...
Like he never says it, but that's definitely the attitude he carries. Like even when that one that he kills, I forget what sequence she was in, sorry. But like she goes like, oh, too bad your friend can't join us. She goes, whatever, I can make that skin warm again. And like she's playing into it when clearly like he's a no bueno human. Human.
Air quotes, yeah.
Yeah, air quotes, human.
I think it's just really interesting that, again, there's a certain sexuality to vampires where there is sort of a kinky edge to it, but in this story, there's a lot of just straight up abuse that's non-consensual, and that's what's missing, what you said, is the consent.
Mm-hmm. And the only time you hear consent mentioned, and mentioned a lot, to the point where it comes across that you remember that he talks about consent and it's a focal point that even he brings up at the end of the movie, is only towards men.
Yeah. We could go about that.
Yeah, we could.
Well, before we dive into the rest of this film, let's take a quick commercial break.
Yep, stay tuned for some more free thoughts. Welcome back, guys. Hope you like those commercials.
So we're at the point in the film and our thoughts where we get the introduction to Kirsten Dunst's character.
Yes, Claudia. The most controversial part of this movie, to be honest, and this movie's full of controversies.
Right? This film is, again, we hate to just throw around buzzwords, but saying problematic is just going to kind of cover our bases on this.
Yeah, it's problematic. It's not kosher. It's not halal. It's
not halal.
It's a little bit haram.
I'm going to go on a limb, Bob, and say that vampires are very haram.
Yeah. But I mean, if they do a little prayer before they kill them, I think you're okay.
We can cover it. It's like saying a blessing over your food. Got it.
Yeah, basically. If they bless the person they're about to kill, I think it's fine. Because then any of our Muslim listeners, please let us know.
Fill us in.
No, but Claudia, though, like, just to, before we get into her character, just what a powerhouse fucking performance by Kirsten Dunst. Like, at first she played a child, which, again, not too much of a stretch because she is a child. So she just had to, like, stretch her acting skills a bit to be like, all right, I'm a vampire now. Or, like, I've lost my mom and blah, blah, blah. These are my dads now. Right? But then to go to, like, being a woman trapped in a child's body, you can't not see that. It's not just her language, it's her execution, it's her body language. Like, yeah, she's dressed up as a doll, but the minute she sees that woman in the window that she ends up killing and storing under all her dolls, and, you know, and she has that, like, realization click in her mind of like, oh, I'm never going to be her, I'm never going to grow up, I'm never going to have breasts, I'm never gonna have a period, I'm never gonna be able to have kids, I'm never gonna be able to have sex with anybody.
Yeah,
like, because she's around sex all the time.
Right
So she's thinking like, okay, I'm just a kid, I'm gonna grow up, I'm just a kid, I'm gonna grow up, I'm just a kid and my life is a nightmare. You know, like, but then it clicks in and it's the female rage.
We love to see it.
And you know what? When I see her go through that, I don't see her as a kid anymore. That's how good she is. Is that I Truly. Don't fit. Like, she's physically, like, my eyes are physically seeing a child, but I'm not seeing a child. I'm seeing a woman. I'm seeing someone that me as a 30-something-year-old woman can be like, fuck yeah, girl. Like,
and that is called range.
Yes.
The whole reason Oh, so the whole reason that they turn her is because Louis finds her, you know, in the alleyway during the plague, which really confused me on the whole timeline, because I was thinking like 1918, but apparently it was a plague well before then.
Yeah, it was the Black Plague. No, that was medieval times. This is like the next plague. It was like, it was a plague, y'all.
It's a plague. Very vague. Yeah. So finds her, realizes her mom is dead. He bites her, thinks he killed her. You know, Lestat finishes turning her. Lestat literally has a kid to save the marriage. Because as you pointed out, like, they were tussling at this point. Louis was over
He knew. He knew Louis was going to leave. This is literally like, okay, I'm going to get myself pregnant to keep my husband around.
I shit you not. My first thought every time I rewatch this film is, wow, this is a gay dad horror comedy.
Yeah. Yep. 100%. 100%. Like, what part of that didn't scream, like, stay together for the kids?
Like, oh my God. I love that there's, again, this discussion around consent where she doesn't get the choice. She has to be a kid forever. And I cannot imagine that, because
No. Like, me being stuck in my body now, like, fine, cured of any health issues I have, cured of any, like, physical issues I have, mental issues, whatever the fuck gets cured by becoming a vampire. Cool. Sure. All right. I'll take it, you know, because I am, again, in my almost mid-30s. Oh, God, almost my mid-30s as of this week. Let's not talk about that. But, like, you know, like, I still have a lot of life to live, but I've lived enough life to know that, like, this is a good point mentally and physically for me to be like, all right, I'm good with this. Let's go.
I was going to ask what age you would pick if you, you know, where do you stop if a vampire offers to turn you? Like, what age do you
stop? I'd say somewhere in your 30s, maybe early 40s, if you want to push it a little bit. But I think then, because you've lived enough life as a human to get a human experience and to be a human for long enough. I'm talking like emotionally, not even just physically. Physically, you passed the mark a while ago, but like you're still in enough peak health given the healthcare that we have these days, whatever fucking healthcare we have these days, to be at a point where like, all right, cool. Like I could do this forever. And I'm at this age and you're an age where you're an adult. So you can not only get into pretty much open up any door in the world for yourself legally, yeah. Like you're the legal age for everything at this point, you know, you're still young enough that like, you can still experience life to its fullest without being discriminated against for like, you know, with ageism and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And you're still wise enough not to do the stupid dumbass things you would do as a kid.
Right, I can't imagine being a vampire in my 20s. I feel like that would suck. I like 30. I'm good with this.
Yeah, 30's a good one.
We like this. I don't need any older or any younger. Honestly, I think all the time about that question of like, what age would I not say yes? Or if I would say yes. But
yes,
Claudia is such a study in female rage because she can never be a woman. And so that fit. Triggered by that realization and the dolls and Lestat trying to offer her yet another doll. And she says, a doll, I have 12 already or whatever, however the number that she says. Yeah. So there's this idea of the infantilization of women, that dollness. And she even calls it out. She's like, am I just your doll mm-hmm. just to dress me up? And it's so interesting to watch a child come to that realization instead of, well, I mean, she technically age-wise, mentally, like you said, is a grown woman. And it says 30 years later. So she would have been in her 30s when she has this realization. And I think that's such a good marker for how so many women our age feel, where we are now fully grown adults, but so many people still see us as little girls. They still see us as these dolls that should have to dress a certain way and act a certain way. And I just find that so validating. Her little killing spree she goes on, by the way, right before. God. The fit is my favorite. When she's like, not in the house, I know.
Yes. And like when she kills her piano teacher and then like Lestat just shoves his body and just like, all right, let me take over.
Jesus. Yeah, that's a whole other. I think too, it's really.
The one that kills me is the woman on the bench. And she's like, mama, I've lost my mama. Mama, are you my mama?
I'm always so weirded out by that one because she looks like the pigeon lady from Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
She does. I didn't realize that till now.
She looks just like her. She does. Every time I see it, I get a little sad. But
yeah, okay. Now I want to.
Sorry.
No, no.
There's that really interesting layer to this that I think Anne Rice could have gone deeper in. And she does in some of her other books and writings.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously not with Claudia because unfortunately Claudia does die here shortly after this.
Yeah.
Also, this film is 2 hours long, but the pacing is so tight because they cram stuff that happens in the books over the course of like a couple of weeks into hours.
Yeah. And they'll do like a montage. So like the whole decision to kill Lestat and the whole Claudia becoming an adult and all that stuff was like many, many chapters worth of stuff. Like, absolutely. I haven't reread the book in a minute, but I remember it taking a lot longer to get to that point. And I remember there being a lot longer at the end that they cut out, too.
Yes, and we'll absolutely have lots of thoughts about that. Just, again, this book has so much to say on, I think, the decision to stay a certain age and what that can do to you. And I think coming at it from, again, a psychoanalytical standpoint is waking up and realizing you've just been accepting what's happening around you for so long, and it took you 30 years or longer sometimes to get there.
Centuries for Louis at some point.
And letting that rage out of you're mad at yourself, you're mad at the people that did this to you. I think it's a great allegory for waking up to abuse or just poor treatment in general, or family systems that clearly don't work.
No, agreed. Like, it's such a good, like, you can't not relate to at least one of these characters at some point in every scene.
Absolutely.
Like, sometimes it shifts. Sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, Lestat, I get you. I see you. I validate your experience. Like, and you know, sometimes it's Claudia, sometimes it's Louis, but like, they're all so relatable. Like,
very.
In that sense as well of like, okay, I've been sleepwalking through my life until this point. Like, Lestat was sleepwalking until he met Louis. You know, Louis was sleepwalking until Claudia, and then he was still sleepwalking until he met Armand. Like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It's such an interesting chain of, I think, all I can think of course, is a TikTok meme. Double it and give it to the next person.
Literally, though. Literally, that is what this is. This is a chain of vampires. This is vampire chainmail.
Oh, my God. Subtitle of the episode, Vampire Chainmail.
The new Christopher Pike spinoff.
Oh, God. Yeah. We're not giving that idea away for free.
No.
So, like you said, there's a decision to kill Lestat and go to Europe afterwards.
Yeah. And just the execution of it, haha, pun intended. It's like, it broke my heart just because, like, on one hand, I'm like, oh my God, this little girl is so fucking callous, but like, look at who she learned from.
Right.
And, you know, the whole like lacing those little cherubic little boys with laudanum.
That realization fucked me up as a teenager. I was like, what? She didn't even, she kept them like that. But then like knowing why she did it. And of course, that very dramatic scene of Lestat bleeding out on the Persian rug.
Her slitting his throat.
Right.
So that he bled out. But like also just that line, this is the part that kills me because I'm just like, oh no. Is like when Lestat goes, so we forgive each other then? And that really like earnest, like the most genuine he's been in this entire movie is in that line. Is like, okay, so we forgive each other then? And she's like, of course. Or whatever she says in her little, like, infantilized voice. Like, yes, of course. And, like, boom. And then Louis is just like, what have you done?
Genuinely, once they set him on fire, I was scared. I was legitimately scared during parts of this. When he's crawling on the ceiling trying to put himself out, that is the creepiest scene. The fact that no one mentions this scene in, like, those, you know, scariest horror movie moments, I'm just like, how is that not scary to you? Something
Listen,
a human being on the ceiling where they're not supposed to be is so scary.
Someone needs to take a still of that, of him on the roof, and just put Malignant 2021.
That's incredibly accurate.
Yes.
Incredibly accurate.
But, like, tell me not. Louis is that dad version of the mom that's just like, I don't know what to do with him. Shrug.
Yeah. Louis definitely is, like, your kid is showing some problematic behaviors, and you're just like, oh, I can't handle this. You
know,
go talk to
this.
Your father.
Disassociate. Time to move to another country.
Oh, God. Listen, that's the most relatable part of this whole thing is when he's like, so we packed up and trips across Europe to find ourselves. Like, don't we all wish we could, you know, do that. That's another.
Do you want to go trips across Europe? Let's go.
Let's go. Let's do it.
Let's go.
But that's the other thing, right? Like, that's my biggest critique is how they breeze through so much of what the book gets into. And I understand that the book is significantly longer than what a 2-hour movie could cover. But
yeah,
the whole trip across Europe is done in a
little montage.
Yeah. Claudia is sketching out the picture of each place as they travel, and it flips through her sketchbook. And then the decision that comes right after this is also done really hastily. But is there anything that you wish we would have gotten to see that we didn't get to see in the movie that's in the book?
Yeah, like I would have liked to have seen Lestat actually come back, make his way to Paris, and like confront everybody like he did in the book.
Yes, same.
Because that's how they found out, instead of this like, oh, you, instead of just the bullshit of like, well, we know you turned a child, so time for some vengeance.
Yeah,
you broke the rules, and then Armand being like, it's just the rules. What are we supposed to do?
Oh God, we'll get to Antonio Banderas in a second.
Yeah, but just the fact that like they didn't kill Lestat actually showed up, and it wasn't a surprise at the end. You know, like cinematically great. You know, having him show up at the end with Christian Slater, and again bringing up consent that is only for men,
right?
but like, you know, Lestat showing up there, and then him and Louis still bumping, crossing paths after Louis and Armand broke up. You know. They were boyfriends.
They were.
This is not even like me making shit up. Like they were fucking boyfriends, except right. They weren't fucking because Anne Rice makes Ken dolls for vampires.
Yeah, that's a whole other critique. I think we have a second episode just on the TV series in us, probably just to talk about that, because it's conveyed very differently in the TV series.
Oh, did they take off the jockstrap?
Kind of. So at this point, they get to Europe. Of course, they go to Paris because where else are two modeling vampires supposed to go?
And yeah, true.
They meet. This part slays me every time. That damn mime vampire they meet in Paris kills me.
Santiago?
Yes. He starts mirroring Brad Pitt. He starts mirroring Louis. And then he's like, what the fuck? And then he just like climbs himself up a wall doing the old, you know, rope. Miming.
Malignant. 2021.
Exactly. That just killed me. And I think that's the best lead in possible to something that What We Do in the Shadows picks up on.
You're dead.
Which we are also huge fans of.
Huge. And we'll probably do an episode on that at some point too. The book the TV and the movie as well.
Absolutely.
Oh man. No, that part killed me because it's like that. No, what killed me was not the miming. The killed me was like when he went up to Louis and started slapping him.
That, Jesus, it makes me laugh every time.
And then Armand comes out like some kind of dungeon master, just being like, stop.
Yes, we finally get to meet Antonio Banderas.
Yes, Antonio Banderas.
Again, this movie was just like, who's hot, who's beautiful on camera.
Do you know what? Of all the characters, So I watched the movie, obviously, before I read the books. I did not read the book when I was 7 or 8 years old. Right. But when I did read the book when I was like 10, you know, because as we've covered on this pod, I read a lot of books at an quote unquote inappropriate age that were given to me by adults in my own family. So what you gonna do? It's not even like I found this shit like on my own. It was more like, here you go. Here's my copy. Read this stuff because you can handle it. No, for real. That's how I started reading like Stephen King. That's how I started my one aunt, and this should have been a clue. My one aunt tried to give me her Dean Koontz to read.
No.
And I could not vibe with it. I could only vibe with one Dean Koontz book, and that was Phantoms. That's it. All his other books are trash.
Yes, correct.
All his other books are trash. Phantoms is the only one I fuck with. But regardless, when I read the book, I went back and I'm like, okay, these kids, you know, Brad Pitt, cool. Tom Cruise, interesting pick, because at that point he started being all
weird,
culty. I will not say the name of his cult. I don't want them to come after us. And then whatchamacallit, you know, Thandi Newton, cool. Like, you know, Christian Slater, amazing. Kirsten Dunst. And then when it got to like Antonio Banderas' Armand, I was like, ooh. Liked his performances, but he was not Armand of the books. I'm okay with it.
Right.
You know, I'm okay with it because it vibed with the movie. But like, if you, because this no scripted or visual medium interpretation of any of these books has given us an Armand. I think I haven't watched the TV show yet, so I don't know if they've got as far as Armand. But none of them go into it. And none of them really go into like later where they go into like his backstory of like ancient Rome and all this other stuff. So it's like you don't really get the gravitas of how old and ancient he is in this. Like he's just like the hot Spanish dude.
Well, and he says, you know, he says, I'm the oldest living vampire still around, but he only says he's 400 years old. And I was like,
yeah, but you don't feel it.
No,
like
not
you
at all.
Don't feel it from him. Like, yeah, okay, fine. He wasn't in ancient Rome. He was in Rome, I believe, at some point, but like he was fucking with some vampires that were from ancient Rome. I forgot their names. It's been a while since I've read the whole series, but like, you don't get that gravity from him. Like you should, like in the book, you actually like, you know, you're like, okay, like the way she describes his gait, even, you know, you're like, okay, he's got the swagger of an old ass man.
Right. Cause he's she's a fantastic writer and he's a fantastic character, but we go kind of right into the Theater de Vampires, which again, famously spoofed in the TV show, What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes.
And I wish we would have gotten, I don't know, they may explore this in the TV show. Again, I just wish we would have gotten the Armand that's in the book solely because of his involvement with this theater.
Yes, yes. I wish we would have gotten more about the theater. I wish an hour of this movie was just devoted to the Théâtre des Vampires, like just to them. Because, first of all, what a fucking way to thrive is vampires under the wire, or under the radar. Like, what a fucking way to thrive.
Right. What is she? Claudia says, vampires pretending to be people pretending to be vampires. Yes. How avant-garde. Such a line. I love it.
Yes. And then, like, when you have that one woman and being like, I volunteer, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, they were smart not to choose her because they're like, oh, no, when she starts screaming, they'll know it's fake. Like,
right. Like,
oh, God, don't. And then when, oh, my God, that move when Armand comes in, he's just like, no pain. You feel no pain. And
that
I'm going
wild.
Like, God damn.
See, again, the sexuality of vampires where, because it was my understanding that, at least from reading other vampire books, and of course I most recently reread Kindred, and I thought of when the vampire is feeding off of you, it's described as feeling good. So yeah. I was confused why people were in pain. Because they're not in pain in other books in this series. I just think it might be continuity error. But anyways.
Yeah. It's that pain for pleasure thing that comes in. So it's like literally a seduction. So it's not eating a meal. It's literally seducing your prey.
Which again, I think there's a whole conversation to be had around kink and consent in this film. And
yeah,
you kind of hit the nail on the head. Exactly. You hit the nail on the head by just saying it's only for men. Just for men.
instead of like Gillette for men, it's consent for men.
For men. So the introduction is fun. We get a really macabre scene that I think kind of plays on a couple of trends that we'd already seen in film, especially in opera. Mm, and then, of course,
very
we get
opera.
Very opera.
Phantom of the Opera type set, though. With like the candles and the
fairy
and the costumes. Like I was expecting to hear it.
And then sort of at this point in the film, things really pick up because we're kind of nearing the end, which again, in the book, this section is,
this is like 75%. Yeah. This is like in the movie, this is 90% of the way through, but in the book, this is only 75.
Yes. So Claudia meets this doll maker in Paris, who
that guy, that bitch.
I don't understand how she convinced this woman really to want to be a vampire, other than the woman says, I know what you are.
Yeah, I think it's implied that she lost her own daughter.
Yes, because she opens her locket, which is very sad. There's a moment she opens the locket and says, you know, I lost my own daughter. But in terms of that, I don't really know what else outside of that.
Knowing Claudia, she probably manipulated her because that's her job.
Right. And that's the other thing. In this series, we get the fact that all vampires have a quote unquote dark gift and it comes to them in different ways. Some people can read minds. I've always understood in vampire lore that they can entrance you. So that's kind of where I was thinking.
Or
I guess
what Charlaine Harris calls glamour.
Yes, glamour. So in the film, unfortunately, they do not get to live together for a couple weeks like they do in the book, which would have been fun to see. But they have a very quick mom and daughter bond. And
it's super, super quick to the point, like it's just enough for us to feel.
Right. Literally right after they turn her, because it's clear to Claudia that Armand and Louis want each other and she's afraid of being alone, which that's the whole trope of she literally can't die. So it's not that she's going to die alone, but she doesn't want to spend the rest of her life that is eternal.
That's it. And alone. Armand even has a line. It's like, it's a cardinal sin to turn a child, like someone that can't take care of themselves out right. there, which is like, yeah, she's in the she's a mind of a woman now, but she's in the body of a child. No one's going to take her seriously. And if she right. starts killing, she's going to get imprisoned, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're an adult, you can go under the radar.
Well, and I think too, there is this idea of the loss of innocence. And so one of the vampires that are at the theater calls Claudia Louis' lover. And he's like, oh, absolutely not. That's my daughter. You know, I would never. Because to vampires.
Claudia got offended at that too, I think.
She did, but not in an overtly sexual way because she's still trapped in the little girl's body. But
she was very possessive of Louis, almost to the point of to lover proportions.
Oh, absolutely. So I'm going to keep this brief because it's a little too heavy, I think, for this point in the conversation. But the idea that it's an allegory for sexuality, they've introduced sexuality to a child, and now she is no longer able to be a child, but she also has to be trapped at that age forever.
Yeah.
So now she is stuck. And it's, again, for me, I view it as you're stuck at whatever age the sexual trauma occurred to you.
It's physical arrested development with mental side effects.
Yes. So I'm going to leave that there. That's a very heavy, I think, deeper conversation to be had. But that's how I read this last quarter of the movie, is the realization.
I agree. And it really comes across in when she's already flipping out by the mere presence of Armand in their life because she can see it coming a mile away. It's like that panicky. It's shades of Lestat. It's the Lestat in her. Mm-hmm. That's like, I can see this threat to my way of life. I can see this threat to my emotional and physical stability, you know, coming at me, and I can't do anything about it. Like, this is the best I can do in this situation without acting like a completely irrational person, because she's learned from when she burned everything down with Lestat. She did grow because she is a woman, and it's been like, what, 30, 40 years since then, even, you know,
it's really interesting how they use childhood in this film. And then of course, unfortunately, right after they turn the doll maker in the film, we don't get that week or so that they live together. We get these vampires from the theater ambushing them.
And it's time for vengeance.
Yes, and dragging them into the chamber. Yeah. And of course, you know, they brick up Louis and Armand rescues him. But Armand chooses to rescue Louis, but not
Claudia
and the doll maker.
Because he knows that it's a hopeless situation, which it kind of is. Like, I mean, I could see her and the doll maker making it, but then they're going to have a mark on their back forever.
Right.
Forever, literally. But also, like, what kills me is, like, when he did turn the doll maker for her, he's like having this existential moment and it's like, please forgive me. And she goes like, for what? And, you know, he's like, you know, what the, not only did that woman in there die, but like the last breath of humanity in me died. And I'm just like, that's really poetic and emo and sounds like an intro to an MCR song, but my heart.
You know, that's why I love this film so much and these books so much. So again, queer subtext, Armand wants Louis, period.
Oh, he no saves question him. About it.
You know, they're walking through the museum and he propositions him. He says, will you be my companion? And Louis turns him down. And I think that's, I don't understand what he wants anymore at that point, because if he was so glamorized by Armand and the whole lifestyle that Armand leads, his version of vampirism, I don't know. Louis makes some questionable choices here.
He does make some questionable choices, but it's also like he's stuck in that stay together for the kids nonsense.
It is stay together for the kids.
Like, that's exactly what that is. It's very much like, I've seen this plot line on every single soap opera, on like every single primetime, like TV show, you know, it's like that, oh, but I have a kid and you're not really about kids. So as much as like, you're probably my soulmate, like I'm gonna choose my kid, even though the kid is like a little terror.
This can't work.
This can't work.
At this point, Louis lost everything, right? And he says, let's set this shit off. And him, for him, I love that. I love it. He literally burns down the theater, douses everything in gasoline, and he uses, well, technically it's their alcohol, but for special effects, you know.
Yeah.
Knocks over their casks of wine, burns everything down. The vampires flying out of their coffins is never not scary / funny to me.
Because it's just a spring action of like,
it is a spring action coffin. They just, so that's kind of where we leave off in his story. He cuts back to present day and says, you know, that's all there is to tell, that I burned down the theater of vampires and made my way back to America. And then we get Christian Slater again.
We didn't have him enough.
Agreed. That man, again, love of my life. Truly wonderful. Didn't listen to a damn thing that Louis said. Did not learn his lesson.
No, he didn't. He was just like, yeah. You're emo. You're sad. You made some questionable personal decisions. Now cut me open. Cut me open, daddy.
Oh my God. Yes. He literally asks, he's like, I don't understand. Like, why wouldn't you? Isn't that why you brought me in here? You want a companion again?
Yeah.
And you know what Christian Slater is in this movie?
What?
Christian Slater is the straight man that can't understand why the gay man isn't hitting on him.
Yes.
He's like, I did everything
100%.
Right. 100%. I don't understand.
Bro, so, why don't you want to fuck me, bro? Bro, right, what's wrong with me? You saying I'm not hot, bro? What's wrong with me, bro?
Exactly. So... Louis like, absolutely not. I'm not going to turn you. They have their little tussle. We get the Malloy fleeing the scene, jumping into his car, making his way across the famous
Golden Gate Bridge.
And Lestat pops up like a damn corpse. Because we do see Louis go back and visit New Orleans after he comes back from Europe, and he finds Lestat, you know, in shambles and not understanding what lights are, apparently.
Yeah.
I didn't understand how he was still alive, truly.
In the book, I believe that was in the 1920s, he runs into him. Oh, so, like, a good 50 years before he even meets Christian Slater. So that's like,
yes.
But in the movie, it's like 2 weeks ago or something like that.
Right. Again, this is such an insanely condensed timeline. But let's talk about the ending.
Okay.
It's camp. It's camp.
I have thoughts. It's very camp. I love
it. Do we like it? Because it's very different than the book.
I love it for the movie. I love it for the choices they made in the movie. I don't love it as an adaptation, obviously, because it made making the vampire Lestat almost impossible.
Yes.
Because, you know, you get his whole history and then him wanting to become a rock star, blah, 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 blah. But that doesn't, I don't see that with Tom Cruise's interpretation of Lestat with the events that he went through.
At all.
I don't see that evolution coming at all. Like, whereas the actual Lestat, like, goes back, like, you know, you get his backstory, you know, like in France, and he gets turned with essentially in vampire rape, and like his mom, and he turns his mom, I think, like, or his mom, I know his mom gets turned. I forget whether it's by the same dude or like he turns his mom, and like, cause he's his prince, in medieval France, you know, and then his whole story of like, you know, ennui and all that kind of stuff. And then he bridges over the part with Louis, then he becomes a rock star. I've now spoiled that book for you, but that book is literally like 30 plus years old. Read it. It's worth it. But he wants to become a rock star, which then leads into Queen of the Damned, which is my problem with Queen of the Damned, the movie, because it's like, okay, you have these two different Lestats.
Yes.
Again, my problem as in my problem with it being part of the series as a standalone movie. Great.
Fine.
Great. We love Aaliyah and Stuart Townsend. But to get to my point, like, this was great for the movie that we saw. I believe that worked. That worked. That would be his ending there, and then him going off and wreaking havoc however he decides to wreak havoc. But I don't, you do, what you don't get in this movie is Lestat's ambition for yes. being important. You got it on the micro level of him with his family, but what you get in the book is his actual ambition to be like, you know, and I'm, you know, his pinky in the brain little, like, you know, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Yeah.
You know, he was looking for the pinky to his brain.
He was the whole movie. So he gives Christian Slater the choice. He says, I'm going to give you the choice that I never have. Again, everyone in this movie, consent except women, gets consent. Yes, consent for men. My favorite kill was the sex worker when he sinks his teeth into her titty. Love that. Yes, love her it. Dress bleeds beautifully. It's just beautiful. It's a beautiful kill.
Yes.
You summed up my final thoughts on the ending perfectly. I love it for this film. It is very campy. I do not love it for the continuation of the series.
No, which is probably why we didn't get like anything until what, like 8 years later?
Like, yeah. Yeah. It was a long haul.
Yeah.
But yes, I'm going to give this movie 4 out of 5 things, and it is a comfort watch for me.
Yes. I'm also going to give it about 4 out of 5 things for me as well. Cause it is, like I said, it had a chokehold on me in the '90s. A lot of things don't carry through, but surprisingly more of it does like stand to the test of time than not, which is kind of weird. You would think it wouldn't, given the subject matter and given the era and things covered that we obviously just covered in this episode. But no, man, great. Beautiful gowns. Beautiful gowns.
Beautiful scenery. We love this movie. All right. Well, Bhavna, where can the people find you?
They can find me at The Lucky Charms on Twitter, Hive, and Instagram. But on Instagram, you have a fancy little underscore at the end because someone took my name. Where can they find you, Jamie?
As always, I'm at Glitter Burrito on Twitter and Hive and almost any other of the new social platforms. My Instagram is my full name, Jamie Kirsten Howard, spelled exactly like Miss Kirsten Dunst. And you can find us as at Bloody Broads Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Patreon, and Gmail. Please, please, please tell a friend to tell a friend. If there's something you would like us to cover, drop us a line, give us a 5-star review, let us know if you like the episode. But until next time, goodbye.
Bye.